This is an ABC podcast.
ABC AFL Daily with Corbin Middlemass, Ben Cameron and Paul Roos.
Here it is!
ABC AFL Daily for your Monday on the back of round 7 of the AFL Premiership season. Corbin and Ben with the Australian Football Hall of Famer in Paul Roos. Firstly, good morning, Ben.
Hello, Corb. I must admit, the footy at the moment, it feels a little bit like COVID times where there's a game every day. We had Monday, then we had a couple of days off, then we had Thursday right through to Sunday. We're off again today on Monday. Great to see you. Great to see you as well, Roosie, over there in Hawaii. Welcome to the 7-time All-Australian Premiership coach. All the rest of it, welcome, Roosie.
Yeah, welcome, boys. I'll second that. It's funny, isn't it? Every time, even me over here, I like it comes on a lot later, but I'm like, oh, geez, the footy's on. Oh, the footy's on. Oh, hang on, the footy's on. You know, like last night I went out for dinner, the Swans-Suns game, and obviously that turned. I saw the first quarter, and I watched the 12 goals this morning, which was painful. But yes, it's so much football, isn't there?
It's developing into a really nice season, so it feels like we had a bit of a slow start to the year, but all of a sudden you look at the table now, you've got Collingwood and Brisbane sort of 1-2, so the last two premiers occupying those spots. Suns coming with a rush, the usual Cats are all there, Geelong, Hawthorn in and amongst it. People love the Giants, even though they've lost a couple on the bounce. Adelaide are the spruik team, the Bulldogs have a spot in the eight, and then the teams on the outside looking in, Fremantle, Port Adelaide, Carlton, Essendon, obviously have to try and get something going. And then there's a certain team wearing red and white and who's a September regular that all of a sudden find themselves 14th on the table. So there's a fair bit for us to pick apart on this Monday.
We'll get to the Swans, no doubt about that. But I want to start with Carlton. I did this game yesterday, Roosie, and I know our producer Jules is very keen to hear about it. Have Carlton got a role to play in the season yet?
100%. Like I said to someone, I was talking to my son just before, and we're talking about the season and how it's going. I said, imagine being a Carlton supporter. If you overlaid Carlton versus Geelong and the Carlton versus Richmond game, it comes down to effort. And we've spoken a lot about this, boys. And I'm not suggesting Carlton weren't trying, but I talk about a lot. There's effort and there's maximum effort. What Carlton are giving now, maximum effort. And for anyone that said, put your hand up and say you're wrong. So for anyone that said they haven't got the cattle, now it's time to go, well, I was actually wrong. They have got the cattle. They've got two gun forwards, two gun defenders, one of which has evolved Jack Silvani over the course of this season. They've got a gun midfield. So put your hand up and say you were wrong. It was actually effort that they weren't giving. Yes, they've got a role to play because they're talented. Now their effort is matching their talent. And that's why, folks out there, it's hard to coach. It's not an easy job to get your players every week in the frame of mind to give 100% maximum effort.
Oh, I just look back through my notes, Roosie. I did the game when they were 0-4 playing the West Coast Eagles. So they hadn't won yet, and everyone was wondering what on earth was going on. I was reading through a bunch of the different stats that we get given to us. They were the number one team defending ball movement at that particular stage. So they were defensively, they were sound, but they were horrible offensively. Just couldn't move the ball to for love nor money at that particular stage. And so they led all four of their games up until that point at halftime. I think now they've led all seven games at halftime. So they've been starting well, fading in a lot of these games. But they obviously had a lot going right through the first month of the season, despite the fact that obviously they didn't have a win to show for it.
Yeah, I think we quoted Cameron Ling at one stage that I think it was after round four. And I mean, we chucked in Richmond, obviously. Ling was talking about the three after that. And so, yeah, I think there was always signs of talent. That's why I'm being critical of these people that said they don't have a great list. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You say that, you've got no idea about footy, to be honest. You know, because they were playing good football when the pressure was up, they were playing really good footy. When the pressure dropped off, their defense couldn't hold up enough and they couldn't score. So there was some good signs. We know they're a talented football team. We know when they give maximum effort. We've seen that over a 3 or 4 year period now, boys, haven't we? It's not like they haven't played great footy. Last year, about round 15 and 16, I think some people had them as premiership favorites. So yes, they're going to have a role to play. Is there wiggle room? No, there's no wiggle room when you start, 0-4, 0-5 or whatever it was, but their best football's really good.
So they recover from 0-4 to get to 3-4. As Corbin mentioned, they've led at halftime in all of their games this year. They've done that once before in their history, Roosie. That was way back in 1908 in the VFL. They won the flag that year in the VFL. So that might be a good omen for the Blues. But
have we got any vision of the 1908 season just to compare Roosie to the modern day Blues?
But if I look back at...
I was only playing under the 19s then, boys, so I can't remember.
Yeah. But Harry Mackay up and going like he was yesterday. Curnow too. Walsh, Wietering. I want to speak to you about Hewitt as well. But I think their bottom six, it felt like they got something out of the likes of Ollie Hollins, if I include him in there. Will White bobbed up with a few goals. Should have had a couple more. The likes of Carroll. They contributed. Those bottom six, Fogarty, if they do that, they'll help the top end. And I think the Blues will be there or thereabouts.
Yeah, look, I think what we see now, most teams haven't got a great deal of depth. And when I'm talking about Talon and Liz, I'm just comparing Carlton not to, you know, not the Brisbane Lions of 01, 02, 03. Mm. I think they're a mile behind that, but you don't have to be now, you know. And I think you're right, Ben. I think if you can get really solid contributions from role players, and I say role players respectfully because they're super important, you know, if they can bob in and tackle and chase and kick a goal here and lock away someone or whatever, and as you're describing it, and you're really good players, of which Carlton have got plenty, are playing well, then you transform yourself into from an 0-4 team and win your next three games pretty quickly.
Yeah, it feels like that's the good and the bad of being at Carlton, isn't it? Once they get that momentum rolling, it's great. You can sort of ride the wave, and when things are going bad, it feels like the house is hotter there than just about any other club in the league.
Just before we move on, so they've got Adelaide at the Adelaide Oval, St Kilda at the MCG, Sydney at the SCG, and then GWS at Docklands. So all of a sudden, that looks like a more favourable run with their form and the form of some of those teams.
Back in town, the Baggers, no doubt about that. One of your former pupils, Roosie, Ross Lyon. So I did this game on Saturday afternoon with Ben, and we couldn't believe it in the second quarter when the paperwork had been filed and the way that the benches are set up, basically, the boundary riders sit behind the glass where the official paperwork comes through. And so sure enough, we got word through from Ray Chamberlain, who was on the boundary for us pretty early, that, hey, they're about to make their sub, and this is tactical. Hugo Garcia is out on the ground, 12-minute mark of the second term. This is a 19-year-old in his 16th game, that he was being ripped from the action, not because of an injury, but because Ross Lyon was going to put Zach Jones in, and he was making a statement, and it felt a little bit like a rage sub, that it was, you know, I've seen enough, he's coming out and he's going into the game. What did you make of that to be able to pull the trigger so early in the game on a young guy?
Well, potentially we may see that a bit more because, I mean, trends can change quickly, boys, in a game. And we're still relatively new to the sub, given our game's been going for 120 years or whatever it's been going. So I think traditionally what it's been used for is let's wait for an injury. If we don't get an injury up until three-quarter time, yeah, let's activate the sub sort of thing. So I think what Ross has done, and let's give Ross the benefit of the doubt, he's been around for a long period of time. I mean, we all get angry, and I'm not dismissing the possibility of Ross being angry. Don't get me wrong. But I think what he's done is sort of gone, well, how can we change, you know, the momentum? We're playing against a team that's in really good form, the reigning premiers. We don't look great. You know, what can I do? And providing you don't get an injury, this is what we don't know, providing you don't get an injury, there's no downside to that, is there? I mean, the downside comes when I think it was Mason Wood that went off with concussion later in the game. I mean, that's when the downside happens, but we don't know at that stage. Look, is it a risk? Yeah, it is. I think we're still gauging the value of the sub and how it can be used. And I think it's a bold move, but I think we'll see it more and more moving forward, particularly with big momentum swings in games.
So Ross Lyon's press conference was must-watch post-game, Roosie, and they often are. He is great media talent, but he spoke about coaching actions and not feelings. What does that mean to you? How do you interpret that?
Yeah, what that means is, what are you seeing rather than what, you know, I love this kid, or I'm presuming, sorry, Rossi, if I'm getting this wrong, you can shoot me a text and correct me. But, you know, we're minus 10 in contested ball. You know, we're not tackling well. That's the tactical. So taking away the emotional side of it is, you know, I love player X. He's had three good games in a row. I've got to back him. You know, our ball movements, it's not that bad, even though we turned the ball over. So there's the intuition side of coaching, which is absolutely spot on. You know, when you're in the box and someone's yapping at you, going, Roosie, you know, we're going to take Leo Barry off, you know, Matty Lloyd. You know, do you trust the player and the emotion of the player, or do you go, yes, he's had you know, four kicked on him or whatever in the first quarter, which Leo did in 2006. So that's really what Rossi's talking about.
People that played under him at St Kilda very much subscribe to the notion that Ross was big on the, you know, execute one to educate a thousand theory. Does it work better off, Rosie, to do that to a senior player rather than a second-year player? Like, should he have made an example out of someone that had, you know, had a few more games under their belt than a second-year teenager?
Well, again, we're sort of speculating as to why he's done it. And look, all coaches make mistakes. So I'll give you try and give you both sides of it, the analytical side of this is what I'm trying to do, which is regardless of whether it's Garcia or Jack Steele or whatever, yeah, you're still there to win the game. Now, the emotional side, you're right. Sometimes it's the senior player you want to execute, but often it's a petulant, and I'm not suggesting Hugo Garcia is a petulant young player, but often it is making a stand with a petulant young player that you want to educate the young players that this is not good enough here. There may be some pressure from some senior players. Rossi, why are you giving, again, not in this instance, but I'm just trying to give you some examples of why it would be different.
I think it's fascinating, and Ross has always been like that. He always, you know better than us, Roos, he always speaks about, you know, confidence is just a feeling. You can't go down the shop and buy it.
Get down the confidence shop and buy the confidence. I love that one.
Yeah, he loves that. But it created a fascinating juxtaposition with Jason Horne-Francis and Ken Hinckley, who was very much coaching feelings. So Ross says, I coach actions, not feelings. Ken Hinckley was certainly coaching feelings on the weekend with Jason Horne-Francis. So I think that's fascinating when you look at the art and science of coaching with these two instances, both from the weekend.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I know the most critical period for your players is when they come in the door when they're 18 years of age. That is the most critical period when you're setting standards. And that's one of the main roles for a senior coach, along with, you know, the assistant coaches and along with the leadership group, et cetera, et cetera. And I know there's some criticism of the North Melbourne Football Club for the way they handled Jason Horne-Francis, but they were trying to set standards with a young player coming in. And we're talking about Jason Horne-Francis a lot, aren't we? Yeah, we're talking about him a lot for on-field stuff, as in kicks, marks, handballs, but we're talking about him a lot for stuff that we shouldn't be talking about him. And the reason we have leadership groups, the reason we have coaches with high standards, is to make sure that guys like Jason Horne-Francis become great team players, great human beings, and great footballers.
So Jack Riewoldt called this out on the television coverage on the weekend, where he basically said, look, it's three-quarter time, game's on the line, North are coming, it's a 12-point game. And instead, you've got Zach Butters trying to calm down Jason Horne-Francis. Yeah. Then they hit the quarter break. Ken Hinckley's talking to him, and then Connor Rosie has to come out. And you think, well, rather than having your focus on the entire group and what we need to do to win the game, the senior coach is there trying to help one guy in particular. I'm sure you've been through similar things, Rosie, in your coaching journey. You know, when does it get to a point, and it's hard because, he's in probably in the top three, top five players, where you go, yeah, is it worth the trouble, how much investment I'm putting into one guy when, you know, it's cool. I've only got 5 minutes with my players. I need to be spending my time differently rather than making sure, you know, he's calm and he's ready to go.
Well, you can't have a really good, high-performing culture, consistent culture, if you're not treating everyone the same in terms of their behaviours. That's what you're asking me, really.
Yeah.
Do clubs spend too much time on talented players that, you know, expend energy from the coaches, from the leadership group? The answer to the question is, put Jason Horne-Francis to a side. The answer to the question is, yes, they do. Absolutely they do. To the detriment of winning premierships at times. Again, I'm not talking about Jason Horne-Francis. What I'm saying, I'm trying to answer your question more, you know, broadly than, because I'm not inside the football club. Absolutely. I think there's clubs over the years that have put individual players ahead of team success and have cost them premierships, 100%.
Yeah, wow. It must be distracting for them to think the level of investment that is involved in that. He's a fourth-year player now too.
At every footy club, I mean, you've got people that empty your cup and you've got people that fill up your cup, don't you? So he needs to be careful not to do that. Just very briefly, Roosie, I mean, I had it put to me by an ex-senior coach that you have to treat everyone the same and yet everyone differently at the same time, which sounds like a contradiction. What's your coaching philosophy around that?
Yeah, I'll explain that more because that's absolutely right. Let me explain that and give you some depth to that comment. You have to treat everyone the same. We have a same set of standards. Let's look at the Bloods culture, which I was involved in starting. Everyone's the same. Everyone turns up to training. Everyone has to train at a certain level, et cetera. Now, we treat everyone differently because their backgrounds are different. Some are studying. Yeah, some are from, they've come from Ballarat and they're living in Sydney. They've got no family. Some have come from Perth. Some are locals. Yeah, Lewis Roberts Thompson's got his family there, et cetera, et cetera. So in that regard, we're treating people differently because we're trying to get the best out of them. So does that explain it?
Yeah.
And absolutely. And that's the art of coaching. Absolutely, the art of coaching. Everyone's the same when they walk in the door. Our stand, that's what I'm talking about with Jason Horne-Francis, what North tried to do with him, what Port are dealing with him at the moment. Because as soon as players see there's a difference in the way we're treating them around turning up the training, training standards, you lose credibility as a coach. You lose credibility as a leadership group. Players respect it, the fact that, oh, guys, just to let you know, Teddy Richards is not a trainer today. He's got an exam on. He's going to come in after. He's going to work with. Oh, fantastic. No problems. Understand, Teddy's trying to study. So hopefully that gives you an explanation as to exactly what that means.
Also the first, but hopefully not the last, Lewis Roberts Thompson mention of on the podcast this year as well, whereas I'm a big fan of LRT. We like that. Still on the coaching game, so the Bulldogs and their premiership coach, Luke Beveridge, 11 years in, he said quite clearly, if I'm not coaching here at the Dogs next year, I won't be a senior coach anywhere else. He wants to stay, wants an extension. They've won a couple of games on the bounce. They have their captain off contract, their coach is off contract. What are they waiting for, the Western Bulldogs, in re-signing Luke Beveridge?
It's interesting to analyse the conversation around it. And I'm trying to pick up largely probably what Luke's saying himself, because they're really good to watch. Mm. Like, I'm loving watching the Western Bulldogs. Like, their work rate offensively and defensively, their pressure around the ball, the way they share the ball with each other and bring each other into the game, they probably still lack a little bit of polish going forward. But, gee, I love watching them play. So in terms of purely football, you're absolutely right. What are we waiting for? I was really interested when he talked about, I think it was Jamara, about whether it mightn't be team performance that allows him to keep the job. That was an interesting conversation. It seems, boys, and I'll throw to you two, it seems like he's, as he would be, it seems like he's been really affected by what's happening with Jamara. And, and it seems like it's having a much bigger weight across the club. And again, I'm reading into a little bit of what he's saying. It sounds like the board are talking about it. The CEO is talking about it. The coach is really concerned about the kid and the impact on the footy club. That's the feeling I get. But again, I'll throw to you boys. Is that, how do you see that?
Well, I draw a parallel to what we were talking about with the Jason Horne-Francis situation and in generalities about players that take a lot of your attention and energy. I think they've expended so much energy on Jamara Ugle-Hagan and trying to assist him where they can. And my mail is the Bulldogs have done a great job of that. They've done everything they can, and now they've basically said, we've got to hand this over to the AFL because it's outside of our remit. But I think he's somewhat emotionally moved on in terms of a football sense from him, which is different to what you were saying there, Roosie. What about you, Corb?
Yeah, my read on it, Roosie, is very much like you talk about the set of standards, that it's very hard to run a football program when you've got one guy that's got his own set of rules that he can sort of come and go as he pleases. And that's really under the AFL's remit. And there's just a complete distrust there, isn't it? Like he's fallen out clearly with the rest of the group. And so imagine you've got this program where we're all in it together and then one guy comes in and out. And so you're sitting there listening to everything. I imagine Jamara's hearing what they're talking about, but then he's away for 4 or 5 days, he's back again, and so you kind of feel like, hang on, we've got this guy sort of coming and going from our program, but he's not really sort of one of us, and if he's not part of it, he may as well not be part of it. So I think he feels like the AFL are kind of trying to manage that situation, and yet I imagine as the senior coach, when you're trying to set standards for the rest of the group, that's really difficult to have sort of one guy come and go in the way that he is.
And I think we probably agree on one thing, Benny, that it seems to be a big thing regardless of, because I tend to agree with both of you. I think he's probably thinking, could I have done any more? But I can't see him playing at the Bulldogs at all. So if you've got a player that is on your list is so important now, there may be pressure from the board, you know, saying, well, we want to keep him. He's a number one draft pick. Yeah, so it just seems, I guess what we're probably all saying, a little slightly different, it just seems more than winning and losing at the moment, doesn't it? It yeah. just seems a club that's playing so well, that looks so, you know, cemented and bolted on and yeah, the collective mindset on the field is so strong. Yeah, it seems concerning, doesn't it, from Luke? Yeah. Now, we don't really know which end of the thread we're at, you know, but it's certainly a concern, isn't it?
My simple sort of sports guy lens on all this, Rosie, I mean, you're the former coach and you would assess it on so many different factors, but just as someone who works in the sports media, when you sort of look at coaches, you think, right, are they getting more than the sum of their parts out of a group? Is that basically what a coach is doing well? Are they maximising what they've got and getting more out of it or less out of it? And I feel like the narrative around Beveridge for a period of time has been, he's got this great list and he's not quite doing enough with it. Feels like this year that's completely flipped, that he's never had more issues. Yeah, Bontempelli's been hurt, Treloar's out, Waitman long-term injury, the Jamara circus, everything that's going on, and yet he's sort of he's making lemonade out of his whatever he's got at the moment in a way that it feels like he hasn't in the past. So it feels like as good a coaching performance that we've seen from Beveridge in just about in his 11 years, you know, premiership aside.
It's very appropriate too that Beveridge is making lemonade.
That's a good one. Good, I agree with that. I think that's great. I think that's a great assessment, Corp. I think the criticism of Luke is he hasn't maximised his list. And right now, you would have to say they're one of the best teams to watch in the competition. So I think that's a great assessment. And I think that's why we're all questioning if he sort of, you know, got through this period of, and we don't know where they're going to finish, why aren't they signing him? So it's clearly a really big issue in some way, shape or form, isn't it? The Jamara issue is a big issue.
Can I just pass a comment on their game on the weekend? Whatever I think I know about football, I learn infinitely more every Monday with Roosie. But I felt like watching the game on Saturday night, it sort of clicked in my head in hindsight, where it's always obvious that they would win that game. I mean, they are the best team at defending ball movement. And GWS, what are they? A ball movement side. So it made perfect sense to me in the second half that they completely shut down the Orange Tsunami and they won comfortably.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's got to be questions on the Giants again. You know, this is the positive, well-done Western Bulldog. But again, boys, I'll ask you the question. Why do the Giants just seem to stumble constantly? Finals last year, 39 points up against Brisbane Lions, smashing the Sydney Swans, you know, all of a sudden Bulldogs. There's a big chink in the Giants' armour, big chink.
I think it's on-field leadership.
Yep.
Yeah, it feels like they're... I saw, not to sort of lean too heavily into all the data and everything else, but Champion Data did a presentation at the start of the year talking about, hey, if the Giants had won it last year, they would have been a huge outlier statistically to be able to go on and win the flag. So even though they were sort of right there at the finish. And then this year, I think they're ranked towards the bottom six for time in front half. And 18 of the last 20 premiers have been top six in that category. So they keep the ball in the front half. And as you did so well, obviously, Rosie, in your coaching days, you know, a territory battle, more so in modern footy than ever before. But, they've got a few deficiencies they've got to try and clean up for such a talented group. I want to talk about the other team in the Harbour City, though, your old side. I did their game yesterday. It was all going swimmingly. 29 points up in just before halftime and the Swans away from home. And then... boom, in a blink of an eye, 12 consecutive goals the Suns kicked. And I was doing the game with Jared Healy, who mentioned that the Swans put up the white flag, and that's something that you so rarely hear about a Sydney Swans team. They got a long injury list, but that was a little alarming yesterday, how dramatically it turned.
Yeah, well, I said I went out for dinner, so what I did this morning is I watched, I said, 12 goals in a row. I mean, that's so unusual in a game of football. So I watched it from, I picked up the thread where I left it. And I expected, because the Suns can be really tough and physical, and they got Rowell and Anderson and, yeah, Took Miller and great midfield. So my expectations watching the game this morning was that, geez, the Suns must have really turned it on. It couldn't have been further from the truth. I couldn't believe, and I'm saying this respectfully to the Suns, it wasn't like the Suns played really well, Corb, was it? It was how bad. Like, it was two holding free kicks from their defenders. It was a 50-metre penalty. It was a turnover. Number of other 50-metre penalties. It was getting smashed at stoppages. I was really, really stunned by what I saw with the 12 goals. And because you can, you know, we all know you can lose games. I mean, it's unusual to get 12 goals, but momentum's huge. The Suns didn't do a lot, did they, to kick 12 goals in a row?
There wasn't a lot of resistance, and it was a warm day. I think it was like 28 degrees and 55% humidity or something, but I mean, it was hot for the Suns as well.
Yeah.
But it was almost like they just got to the point, Sydney, and this is so, I think what's so shocking about it is it's so uncharacteristic for the Swans, but it was like they just went, this is all a bit too hard today.
Not today, coach, too hard.
It just, yeah, that's I don't know. If they.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and again, Sydney have been so good for so long, and that's why we're all sort of shocked when it happens. But, yeah, I mean, I'm getting text messages exactly, you know, bloody oath. I'll give you one. Bloody oath, too many pretty footballers, need tough, ugly players like Kirk, Bolton, Matthews. And I think that's what we're – and, again, we love them. We don't want to be overly critical, but it's hard to be great for so long, you know. Mm-hmm. But you have to front up physically and mentally week in, week out, and that's what's been the strength of the Swans. And what we're seeing now, this group has to stamp itself now. Yeah, Dean Cox, Isaac Heaney, Chad Warner, Nick Blakey, you know, they're all good. And I know he's not playing. This group, it's time for them to stand up and say, right, this is who we are. We are going to be a physical team because at the moment, I said it last week, they're the Harlem Globetrotters. They're not physical. Mm. When it gets too hard, you know, they just sort of turn it up. Unless Isaac puts on a clinic, Isaac Heaney, it's all over really, isn't it?
Yeah, their depth is going to be really tested. So they got 10 on the injury list. 7 or 8 of those are in their best 23. Ben Patton nicked his calf yesterday, so make that 11 on the injury list. And no returns for the Sydney Derby on Saturday. So the Battle of the Bridge, they won't be getting anyone back. Mills is at least another week away. Last year, Ben, Sydney's fifth loss occurred in July. They've got 5 losses already, and we're not even out of April. So very uncharacteristic.
I think again, just to be clear, let's be clear, but it's not about wins and losses. What we're saying is not, because they have got injuries. What we're saying is it's the way the Swans are playing. That's the concerning factor. They could have been beaten by the Suns by, you know, 20, 30 points and still had a really good, you know, good game. You know, tough and hard and physical and scrapped and got the ball back and put pressure on. And we're seeing it constantly by teams that haven't got as much talent. They can hang in for periods of time. Yeah, and they can win. A la Richmond have won 2 games on the back of some really good pressure. So it's not about wins and losses for Sydney. It's about the way they're going about their football at the moment.
All right, Roosy, last one from me. But how confused are you with the umpiring at the moment?
To the point, Ben, where I have to sort of switch off the umpiring, because if I dissect some of the decisions, there was one on Ollie Wines, and I was like, he got hit in the head. He had no prior opportunity, and there was a free kick for holding the ball. And that's what I'm sort of seeing. I'm seeing things that I've really never seen before. 50-metre penalties that I go, well, hang on, what is that for? Holding the balls, 15-metre. I don't know what you guys, what are you seeing? How are you seeing it? And you're at games and hearing fans' reaction. How are you seeing it?
Oh, I think there's a growing – we don't want to be umpire bashers. No one on this podcast does. I think there's a growing chorus of people who are struggling to understand the officiating. And we get a great insight every Saturday from Ray Chamberlain, who's on the boundary for us. So I think what Corb and I have learned is there's so many things in the game that we don't even know about. And an example of that is when there's a free kick backward of centre, if there's a free kick paid and someone else takes the mark – whoever takes the mark, they'll just allow them to take the kick. When it's forward of centre, the free kick has to go to the person who was infringed. So there's just little things like that you know, a lot of people wouldn't even know. But Ray's greatest insight for me over the weekend was when they went from 3 umpires to 4, generally year on year they would add in 1 or 2 new umpires and 1 or 2 would drop off. They added 10 fresh who may otherwise have been umpiring in the VFL this year and last year and still learning their craft. Instead, they're straight into the AFL and learning their craft on the run. So we've got a brand new batch of umpires that are learning on the job, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think it's just the absolute clangers. I've said this for 30 years or 20 years. It's the hardest game and we keep changing the rules. It's so hard to umpire. So I think we just got to make it easier for the umpires rather than harder. And then you start adding layers, as Ray said. You add another 10 umpires in, you add 10 new umpires with slightly different interpretations, less experience. The crowds 80,000 at the MCG, et cetera, et cetera. There's layers that they haven't dealt with before, not just actually blowing the whistle. It's hearing the crowd noise. So I just think we've got to make it a lot easier for the umpires to umpire.
100%. Yep. Yeah. Strip it all back, get the important stuff right, and worry about all the little stuff a lot less. Good head out, Roosie. You're off tomorrow, but we'll hear from you a little bit later in the week right here on ABC AFL Daily.
Thanks, guys. Good chatting.
So don't forget, new drop available every day right here through the ABC AFL Daily podcast for your news and discussion. Poppy Penny's in the chair tomorrow, and Luke Ball is in for a little one-day-only edition. So we'll hear from Bally here tomorrow, and then Roosie will be back later in the week. Keep it locked, ABC AFL Daily.